Chapter 5 Sea Dreams. Late in the morning, Sparrowhawk took the Mage Wind from the sail, and let his boat go by the World's Wind, which blew softly to the south and west. Far off to the right, the hills of southern Wathort slipped away and fell behind, growing blue and small, like misty waves above the waves. Arryn woke. The sea basked in the hot gold noon, endless water under endless light. In the stern of the boat, Sparrowhawk sat naked, except for a loincloth and a kind of turban made from sailcloth. He was singing softly, striking his palms on the thwart as if it were a drum, in a light, monotonous rhythm. The song he sang was no spell of wizardry, no chant of deed of heroes or kings, but a lilting drone of nonsense words, such as a boy might sing as he herded goats through the long, long afternoons of summer in the high hills of Gaunt, alone. From the sea's surface, a fish leapt up and glided through the air for many yards on stiff, shimmering vanes, like the wings of dragonflies. "We're in the South Reach," Sparrowhawk said when his song was done. "A strange part of the world, where the fish fly and the dolphins sing, they say. But the water's mild for swimming, and I have an understanding with the sharks. Wash the touch of the slave-taker from you." Arryn was sore in every muscle, and loath to move at first. Also, he was an unpracticed swimmer, for the seas of Enlad are bitter, so that one must fight with them rather than swim in them, and is soon exhausted. This bluer sea was cold at first plunge, then delightful. Aches dropped away from him. He thrashed by Lukfar's side like a young sea-serpent. Spray flew up in fountains. Sparrowhawk joined him, swimming with a firmer stroke. Docile and protective, Lukfar waited for them, white-winged on the shining water. A fish leapt from sea to air. Arryn pursued it. It dived, leapt up again, swimming in the air, flying in the sea, pursuing him. Golden and supple, the boy played and basked in the water and the light until the sun touched the sea. And dark and spare, with the economy of gesture and the terse strength of age, the man swam and kept the boat on course and rigged up an awning of sailcloth and watched the swimming boy and the flying fish with an impartial tenderness. "Where are we heading?" Arryn asked in the late dusk, after eating largely salt meat and hard bread, and already sleepy again.
"Lorbenry," Sparrowhawk replied, and the soft, meaningless syllables were the last word Arryn heard that night, so that his dreams of the early night wove themselves about it. He dreamt he was walking in drifts of soft, pale-coloured stuff, shreds and threads of pink and gold and azure. He felt a foolish pleasure. Someone told him, "These are the silk fields of Lorbenry, where it never gets dark." But later, in the fag-end of the night, when the stars of autumn shone in the sky of spring, he dreamt that he was in a ruined house. It was dry there. Everything was dusty and festooned with ragged, dusty webs. Arryn's legs were tangled in the webs, and they drifted across his mouth and nostrils, stopping his breath. And the worst horror of it was that he knew the high, ruined room was that hall where he had breakfasted with the masters in the great house on Roke. He woke all in dismay, his heart pounding, his legs cramped against the thwart. He sat up, trying to get away from the evil dream. In the east there was not yet light, but a dilution of darkness. The mast creaked. The sail, still taut to the north-east breeze, glimmered high and faint above him. In the stern his companion slept sound and silent. Arryn lay down again and dozed till clear day woke him. This day the sea was bluer and quieter than he had ever imagined it could be, the water so mild and clear that swimming in it was half like gliding or floating upon air. Strange it was, and dreamlike. In the noontime, he asked, "Do wizards make much account of dreams?" Sparrowhawk was fishing. He watched his line attentively. After a long time, he said, "Why?"
"I wondered if there's ever truth in them."
"Surely."
"Do they foretell truly?"
But the mage had a bite, and 10 minutes later, when he had landed their lunch, a splendid silver-blue sea bass, the question was clean forgotten. In the afternoon, as they lazed under the awning rigged to give them shelter from the imperious sun, Aaron asked,
"What do we seek in Lorbenry?"
"That which we seek," said Sparrowhawk.
"In Enlad," said Aaron after a while, "we have a story about the boy whose schoolmaster was a stone."
"Aye? What did he learn?"
"Not to ask questions."
Sparrowhawk snorted as if suppressing a laugh and sat up.
"Very well," he said, "though I prefer to save talking till I know what I'm talking about. Why is there no more magic done in Hort Town and in Narvaduin, and maybe throughout all the reaches? That is what we seek to learn, is it not?"
"Yes."
"Do you know the old saying, rules change in the reaches?" "Seamen use it, but it is a wizard saying, and it means that wizardry itself depends on a place. A true spell on Roke may be mere words on Ifish. The language of the making is not everywhere remembered. Here one word, there another. And the weaving of spells is itself interwoven with the earth and the water, the winds, the fall of light, of the place where it is cast. I once sailed into the east so far that neither wind nor water heeded my command, being ignorant of their true names. Or more likely it was that I was ignorant. For the world is very large, the open sea going on past all knowledge, and there are worlds beyond the world. Over these abysses of space and in the long extent of time, I doubt whether any word that could be spoken would bear everywhere and forever its weight of meaning and power. Unless it were that first word which Segoy spoke, making all, or the final word which has not been nor will be spoken until all things are unmade. So, even within this world of our Earth Sea, the little islands that we know, there are differences and mysteries and changes, and the place least known and fullest of mysteries is the South Reach. Few wizards of the inner lands have come among these people. They do not welcome wizards, having, so it is believed, their own kinds of magic. But the rumors of these are vague, and it may be that the art magic was never well known here, not fully understood. If so, it would be easily undone by one who set himself to the undoing of it, and sooner weakened than our wizardry of the inner lands. And then we might hear tales of the failure of magic in the south. For discipline is the channel in which our acts run strong and deep. Where there is no direction, the deeds of men run shallow and wander and are wasted. So that fat woman of the mirrors has lost her art and thinks she never had it. And so Hare takes his hazir and thinks he has gone farther than the greatest mages go, when he has barely entered the fields of dreams and is already lost. But where is it that he thinks he goes? What is it he looks for? What is it that has swallowed up his wizardry? We have had enough of Hort Town, I think. So we go farther south, to Lorbenry, to see what the wizards do there, to find out what it is that we must find out. Does that answer you?
Yes, but...
Then let the stone be still a while, said the mage. And he sat by the mast in the yellowish, glowing shade of the awning, and looked out to sea, to the west, as the boat sailed softly southward through the afternoon. He sat erect and still. The hours passed. Aaron swam a couple of times, slipping quietly into the water from the stern of the boat,
for he did not like to cross the line of that dark gaze which, looking west over the sea, seemed to see far beyond the bright horizon line, beyond the blue of air, beyond the boundaries of light. Sparrowhawk came back from his silence at last, and spoke, though not more than a word at a time. Aaron's upbringing had made him quick to sense mood, disguised by courtesy or by reserve. He knew his companion's heart was heavy. He asked no more questions. And in the evening he said, "If I sing, will it disturb your thoughts?" Sparrowhawk replied with an effort at joking, "Well, that depends upon the singing." Aaron sat with his back against the mast and sang. His voice was no longer high and sweet as when the music master of the Hall of Barila had trained it years ago, striking the harmonies on his tall harp. Nowadays the higher tones of it were husky, and the deep tones had the resonance of a viol, dark and clear. He sang the Lament for the White Enchanter, that song which Elfarin made when she knew of Mored's death and waited for her own. Not often is that song sung, nor lightly. Sparrowhawk listened to the young voice, strong, sure, and sad between the red sky and the sea, and the tears came into his eyes, blinding. Aaron was silent for a while after that song. Then he began to sing lesser, lighter tunes, softly, beguiling the great monotony of windless air and heaving sea and failing light as night came on. When he ceased to sing, everything was still, the wind down, the waves small, wood and rope barely creaking. The sea lay hushed, and over it the stars came out, one by one. Piercing bright to the south, a yellow light appeared and sent a shower and splintering of gold across the water. "Look, a beacon!" Then, after a minute, "Can it be a star?" Sparrowhawk gazed at it a while and said finally, "I think it must be the star, Gabardon. It can be seen only in the south reach. Gabardon means crown. Kurum Kamara taught us that. Sailing still further south, one would bring, one by one, 8 more stars clear of the horizon under Gabardon, making a great constellation. Some say of a running man, others say of the rune Agnon, the rune of ending." They watched it clear, the restless sea horizon, and shine forth steadily. "You sang Elfarin's song," Sparrowhawk said, "as if you knew her grief, and made me know it too. Of all the histories of Earthsea, that one has always held me most. The great courage of Mored against despair, and Seriath, who was born beyond despair, the gentle king, and her, Elfarin. When I did the greatest evil I have ever done, yet it was to her beauty that I thought I turned. And I saw her for a moment. For a moment I saw Elfarin." A cold thrill went up Aaron's back. He swallowed and sat silent, looking at the splendid, baleful, topaz-yellow star. "Which of the heroes is yours?" the mage asked. And he answered, "Erith Akby." He was indeed the greatest. "But it is his death I think of, alone, fighting the dragon Orm on the shore of Celador. He might have ruled all Earthsea, yet he chose that instead." The mage did not answer. Each followed his own thoughts a while. Then Aaron asked, still watching yellow Gabardon, "Then it is true that the dead can be brought back to life by magery?"
"They can be brought back into life," the mage said.
"But is it ever done? How is it done?"
His companion seemed to answer with very great reluctance.
"By the spells of summoning," he said, or scowled or winced. as he spoke. Aaron thought he would say no more, but presently he went on, "Such spells are in the law of Paun. The Master Summoner will not teach or use that law. It has been used seldom, and never wisely, I think. The great spells of it were made by the Grey Mage of Paun 1,000 years ago. He summoned up the spirits of the heroes and mages, even Ereth Akbi, to give counsel to the lords of Paun in their wars and government. And what happened? The counsel of the dead is not profitable to the living. Paun came on evil times. The Grey Mage was driven forth. He died nameless." The mage spoke reluctantly, but he did speak, as if he felt Aaron had a right to be answered. And Aaron pressed on. "Then no one uses those spells now?"
"I have known only one man who used them freely."
"Who was he?"
"He lived in Havna. They accounted him a mere sorcerer, but in native power he was a great mage. He made money from his art, showing any who paid him whatever spirit they asked to see, dead wife or husband or child, filling his house with unquiet shadows of old centuries, the fair women of the days of the kings. I saw him summon from the dry land my own old master, who was archmage in my youth, Nemel, for a trick to entertain the idol. And the great soul came at his call like a dog to heel. I was angry and challenged him. I was not archmage then. I said, 'You compel the dead to come into your house. Will you come with me to theirs?' And I made him come, though he fought with me with all his will and changed his shape and wept aloud in the darkness."
"So you killed him?" Aaron whispered, enthralled.
"No. I made him follow me and come back with me. He was afraid. He who summoned up dead so easily was more afraid of death, his own death, than any man I knew. At the Wall of Stones. But I tell you more than a novice ought to know, and you're not even a novice."
Through the dusk, the keen eyes returned Aaron's gaze, abashing him.
"No matter," said the archmage. "There is a wall of stones, then, at a certain place on the bourne. Across it the spirit goes at death, and a living man may cross it and return again if he knows the way. By the wall of stones, this man crouched down on the side of the living. He clung to the stones with his hands, and wept and moaned. I made him go on. His fear made me sick and angry. I should have known by that I did wrong. I was possessed by anger and by vanity. He was strong, and I was eager to prove that I was stronger."
"What did he do afterwards, when you came back?"
"Grovelled, and swore never to use the Pelnish law again, and kissed my hand, and would have killed me if he dared."
"What became of him?"
"He went west from Havna, to Paun, perhaps. I heard no more of him. He was white-haired when I knew him, or still a quick, long-armed man, like a wrestler. He would be dead by now. I cannot even bring to mind his name."
"His true name?"
"No, that I can remember."
Then he paused, and for the space of 3 heartbeats was utterly still.
"They call him Cobb in Havna," he said in a changed, careful voice. It had grown too dark for expression to be seen. Aaron saw him turn and look at the yellow star, now higher above the waves, and casting across them a broken trail of gold as slender as a spider's thread. After a time he said, "It's not only in dreams, Aaron, that we find ourselves facing what is yet to be in what was long forgotten, and speaking what seems nonsense because we will not see its meaning."